Les colloques du Collège de France.
Je vais immédiatement passer la parole à Piotr Aleksandrovitch. Piotr Aleksandrovitch est maître de conférence, assistant professeur à l'université Adam Mickiewicz à Poznan. Il travaille sur le jus commune et en particulier sur le droit canonique de l'époque moderne. Et évidemment, son intérêt pour le sujet de notre colloque est central, les paratextes, puisqu'il est le principal investigator, le responsable scientifique de l'ERC Starting Petrius, Petrification of Jus Commune through Printed Paratexts. C'est un projet qui vient de débuter, je pense qu'il va nous parler de cela. Vous avez un support qui circule actuellement dans les rangs, sa présentation s'intitule Printed Canon Law Paratext up to circa 1600. Dear Piotr, the floor is yours.
Bonjour, c'est un privilège pour moi d'être ici et je suis très reconnaissant aux organisateurs de m'avoir invité et accueilli, ainsi qu'à Xavier d'avoir pensé à moi et d'avoir suggéré ma participation aux responsables de l'organisation. Je suis très heureux de présenter les premiers résultats de nos recherches sur les paratextes juridiques imprimés. Je suis particulièrement honoré de pouvoir parler des livres de droit canonique qui ont été enseignés au collège pendant près de 2 siècles. Je suis également reconnaissant d'avoir la possibilité de m'exprimer en anglais, ce qui m'évitera de malmener la beauté de la langue de Molière. Par conséquent, je ferai ma présentation en anglais, mais bien que mes diapositives et table de matière soit en français. 185 years ago, the Polish poet and today patron of my alma mater, Adam Mickiewicz, was appointed to the chair of Slavic literature at the Collège de France. The aim of the poet professor's lecture was to present to a French audience the spirit of Slavic languages and literature. As one commentator has observed, he was aware that his task was to co-create the knowledge of the center about the periphery. Today I will also explore the tension between center and periphery, albeit within the scope of a single talk and on a subject very different from Slavic poetry and literature. Here, center and periphery refer not to geographical spaces, but to the spatial proximity of texts on the printed page. In the addition to the 2 sections I was asked to prepare, Status Questionis and Future Research Perspectives, I will also present the variety of printed legal paratexts. Let me begin by stressing the obvious. The printing revolution had a remarkable impact on law and legal scholarship in many respects. Above all, it transformed the ways in which legal texts were circulated. While we know a great deal about the printing of civil law books and somewhat less about those of canon law, we know surprisingly little about the development of the printed paratexts. The literature on printing of Corpus Juris Civilis is extensive and has a long-standing tradition. It began nearly 3 centuries ago with Henrik Brenkmann, was developed further by 19th century German scholars, and has continued to benefit from significant contributions in the more recent scholarship. For canon law, the volume of scholarship is much smaller. Most attention has been devoted to the printing of the Decretum, in particular 19th century research studies. Another significant contribution emerged with the revival of Gratian studies in the mid-20th century, which led in particular to an extensive survey of all printed editions of the Decretum. As for the other parts of the corpus, there has been far less research, with notable exception of the Extravagantes. Of course, there are some insights into this topic, as well as more general overviews of early printed canon law books, but these remain quite broad in scope. The state of the art for printed paratexts in the corpora juris is similarly uneven. For civil law, there is a long and well-established tradition of examining handwritten paratexts, which is crucial importance for the study of their printed counterparts. Extensive research on certain types of paratexts provides a very detailed picture of the manuscript tradition of the ordinary gloss and its additiones, even though printed marginalia and civil law books have not been studied as extensively. There is also some scholarship on other types of marginalia, such as casus longi, summaria, and casus breves, and in addition, humanist paratitla have attracted scholarly attention. However, for the remaining paratextual materials, our knowledge remains extremely limited. In the case of canon law paratexts, we again know the most about the Decretum, and we should stress again the importance of 19th century German scholarship. The works of Schulte addressed not only the editing of the Glossa Ordinaria to the Decretum of Bartholomew of Brescia, but also other forms of marginalia such as casus, divisions, and biblical references. Later contributions included studies on variations within the gloss in Incunabula, as well as on the Chapuis and Correctores Romani recensions of the source texts. The development of the ordinary gloss to the Decretals and the manuscripts has been studied by Stefan Kattner, who also examined early printed variants of Casus Longi and Additiones. Nevertheless, much remains to be done regarding the transmission of the gloss in print. For other parts of the corpus and for other types of paratexts, the scholarship remains limited. A good example is provided by summaries which for centuries were treated only cursorily, and only very recently has research demonstrated how dynamic and significant these paratexts are. Against this background, scholarship addressing more general issues and neighboring fields is also of relevance, and by this I refer to, among others, book history and legal books in particular, knowledge management in the Renaissance, the dissemination of legal knowledge, scholarship on printed paratexts in neighboring fields, biblical studies, theology, philosophy. One final point should be added to conclude this bird's eye view of the status Christianis. Today, a game-changing source of information on printed books is provided by state-of-the-art bibliographical databases of works printed in the 15th and 16th centuries. These constitute indispensable and invaluable tools for any research on the subject. So the general conclusion is that we still lack a detailed, thorough, comprehensive, and methodologically informed treatment of printed paratexts in the Corpora Juris. For this reason, before presenting avenues for future research, I would like to offer a preliminary attempt to organize this unexplored material. Let me first move to a bit broader perception of paratexts, not only as marginalia, but everything added to the normative texts. For the sake of clarity, we should distinguish between at least three types of such paratexts. The first type comprises all those additions to the main text of the printed book that are labeled as paratexts, for example, by book historians, title pages, prefatory letters, colophons. Although they were usually neither authored by lawyers nor concerned with legal matters, they are relevant to our understanding of legal books for a variety of reasons. The second type of paratext comprises those directly linked to the legal content of the book, but to varying extents, autonomous, and added to the main body of the text as external works, either at the beginning or towards the end of the book, such as biographies, indexes, or long summaries. The third type is marginalia, that is, all non-authoritative paratexts that are closely related to the authoritative texts by spatial proximity, such as glosses, summaries, cases, editions. These paratexts were usually authored by lawyers and are directly related to the legal content of the printed books. To present this variety of paratexts, I will use the Decretum and the Decretals as examples, as these are good representatives of canon law printing overall and in many instances also of the printing of civil law books. Obviously, printing legal books was a natural successor to writing and copying legal books by hand. These two modes of book production largely overlapped, so there is no simple narrative to explain the complexity of the interactions between handwritten and early printed books. There are also many printed books annotated by hand, and these handwritten paratexts are also of primary importance for research on printed ones. Studies on the transmission of normative printed texts could focus on the quality of the variants used for the printed books, related to some relevant questions. On one hand, these questions can also be asked with regard to the paratextual strata, but on the other hand, to understand the latter, it seems that we can pose a distinctive set of questions. These questions show, to some extent, printed paratexts had their own distinct story, different from the history of publishing the legal texts themselves, as they required different editorial choices of the people involved in their production. In publishing canon law books, printers from the very beginning imitated the mise en page of the manuscripts. The first printed editions of the canon law books, the Decretum and Decretals from 1471 by Eggestein, already applied the Agora template, or modus modernus, with the authoritative text in the center and the ordinary gloss in the margins. In this respect, we could say that the early imprints were heavily inspired by the manuscript tradition, although this was only the beginning. What followed was a departure from this starting point, as the new editions were in most cases unprecedented in the manuscripts. While the changes in the paratextual strata were usually not of great magnitude, one by one, these experiments with paratext reshaped the body of non-authoritative material in printed canon law books. The center margin format was in most cases still preserved, but the amount of new material changed significantly. Still, we must keep in mind that vast part of the printed paratext was preceded by the analogous forms present in manuscripts, even if as undeveloped germs. To better understand all these developments, we will take a look at individual paratexts, though my treatment of paratexts other than marginalia will be very brief, as it's not wise to stay between the audience at the lunch. Colophons were a crucial source of information about books in the earliest decades of printing, and this was also the case for canon law books. They varied in length and level of detail. Even in the case of short colophons, what was constantly stressed by printers in the age of incunabula was that their editions of the sources were corrected or revised. From other colophons, we can learn more about the contents of the printed books and the people involved in their production. Title pages are obviously the ordinary paratexts of highest relevance, although their role increased only with the passage of time. In the earliest printed editions, there were no title pages, and the title of the work could be inferred only from the colophon. As the 16th century progressed, colophons lost their informative value and eventually disappeared, while title pages contained more and more information. Another type of paratext that could be a very rich source of information about a given edition of a source text is letters, the most popular being prefatory letters. For the Decretum, we find such letters in fewer than one-fourth of the incunable editions. When we look at the Decretals, alongside praise of the new editions and eloquent encouragements for the study of canon law inspired by various authorities, we can also find rationales for adding new paratexts or hints at their intended functions. Among the less popular ordinary paratexts, we may count, for example, woodcuts, poems, or privileges. Let's now move on to discuss the semi-autonomous texts that were added to the legal sources as legal books grew in volume. Those were usually paratexts that were designed to support the reader in orienting himself and the contents of the book, or helping him to find the relevant texts, but they were not included within the authoritative texts, and thus I call them external. In what follows, I will focus solely on Decretum as its printing witnessed the most robust selection of new external paratexts. Various verse or prose summaries of contents were added to the legal text in early printed books. The first such summary included in the Decretum was Flos Decreti. This summary of the contents of Gratian's compilation, originally authored by the 13th century Spanish canonist, was included in four incunable editions of the Decretum and then again reprinted only much later. List of contents were another novelty of the 1490s, but things changed rapidly with the advent of the Paris edition of the Corpus Juris Canonici. Starting with the 1501 edition, multiple lists of contents were added. Moreover, the Paris joint initiative of Chapuis and various printers resulted in the creation of the first indexes, which particularly call for attention as most practical legal paratext. Another way of presenting the contents of the Decretum was offered by the work titled Margarita Decreti, originally written in the 13th century. Again, although a few manuscripts contained both Decretum and Margarita, it was only 200 years after the work's creation that it was inserted as a paratextual addition to the Decretum. It proved so successful that it was retained in most later printed editions. Yet another forms introduced by way of paratext were that of biographies of lawgivers, the visual devices, or the Tabula Bolognini. Let us now move to those paratexts that were closely related to the authoritative text by spatial proximity. While I call them marginalia, as they were most often placed in the marginal columns surrounding the central text, some of these marginalia were placed within the central space or in the margins of those columns. Obviously, the main and most relevant marginal paratext was the ordinary gloss. That was the standard apparatus of legal books, which was petrified in a fixed form relatively shortly after the creation of the respective legal texts. The inclusion of this paratext was a natural consequence of following the contents and page layout of handwritten books. One of the first signals of change in the marginal paratext to enhance the user experience was the addition of the numbering of distinctiones in the Decretum in Jenson's Venice 1474 edition. Another small addition to the standard apparatus was references to scripture. For the Decretum, we can find them for the first time in the 1493 Basel edition by Froben. Although a small one, it seems to have proved useful, as it was reiterated in many later editions up to Editio Romana. Now, my favorite topic. So among the most intriguing marginal paratexts are summaries. That is, short provisions encapsulating the core of the canon to which they were attached. They were located in the center of the page and thus acquired a status as close as possible to the authoritative text, to the degree that for many it became obvious that summaries must have been part of the original legal collections. While in the Decretum we find summaries already incorporated in manuscripts, so their presence in printed books is no surprise, the summaries in the Decretals provide a fascinating example of paratextual development. They were first added in 1489 Venice edition of Battista Torti, thanks to the involvement of a learned scholar, Gerolamo Chiari. As there was no established tradition of summaries in the manuscripts of Liber Extra, it was Chiari's innovation to extract them from the commentaries on the Liber Extra. He did not create the summaries, but made clever use of doctrinal writings. From the early 14th century, the inclusion of a summary as the opening paragraph in legal commentaries was standard practice and provided Chiari with a set of texts ready for reuse, as with this very famous notion, Pacta Sunt Servanda. In this way, what was originally a doctrinal statement became part of the edition of the legal text itself, included in the center of the page. For this reason, the summaries had a number of functions. Beyond authoritative and interpretative ones, they were also considered useful for learning and teaching law, as well as for better understanding the consensus of scholars on the interpretation of canons. It seems that to some extent, the summaries were used as a tool to petrify, that is to consolidate, the prevailing opinion of learned authors on the interpretation of the respective canons. Once the summaries were added to the Decretals, they were retained in almost all later editions, including even 19th century critical editions of the collection. Printers and editors experimented extensively with summaries. Sometimes they added another variant or even two variants in the margins, and there were also at least two distinct traditions of summaries, following either the earlier ones by Johannes André or the later ones by Niccolò de Tudeschi. And here you can see the table with three main variants labeled ABC and their presence in various editions of printed commentaries and Liber Extra. Another editor greatly involved in these experiments was a French learned jurist, Jean Chapuis. So the summaries were also, from the very beginning, explicitly advertised in colophons, titles, or prefatory letters, the latter also providing rationales for printing summaries and arguments for their relevance in learning. Another typically legal paratext was the casus. Although they were not necessary for the Decretum, which to a large degree was based on the detailed presentation of fictitious cases, they provided a form of presenting the facts of a case that supplemented the contents of the Decretals. The work that best served this purpose was the Casus Longi by Bernard of Parma. This work was printed several times as a separate incunabul, but it was also used to enrich the Decretals and was inserted into the marginal strata in a fragmented form for the first time in Venice edition by Andrea di Calabria. While this was not common in the later incunabula, it became a standard paratext in 16th century editions of the Decretals, and eventually presentations of cases were also added to the Decretum. There were many other minor forms we can find in the thicket of paratexts surrounding the authoritative canon law texts. Here I will focus again on the Decretals, as they witnessed the most robust growth of these forms. In the Torti edition, following the one that introduced Sumaria, we again find multiple novelties. There were added, for the first time, communes divisiones, that is, short presentations of the respective canons organized by dividing the following text into paragraphs excerpted from the works of renowned jurists, and continuationes rubricarum, which were a kind of summarized contents of the full titles of the Decretals. Another type of marginalia were additiones, divisiones titulorum and notabilia, again added by Torti, in this case in 1505. While not all of these were later retained in subsequent editions, most of them proved to be successful additions to the standard apparatus. Among the later ones, we can count explanations to the gloss in the outer margin, commentaries on the rubrics, or even mere technical improvements, such as adding letters referring to the glosses not only above the glossed words, but also in the larger font in the separate column, and the printer was very proud of it. Special mention should be made of the humanist editions of printed legal books, which for half a century were produced alongside the classical editions of the sources. This movement appears to have been initiated in Paris in the 1520s. Once again, the collaboration between a printer, Claude Chevalon, and an editor, Louis Blaublom, brought to light the innovative editions of legal texts. Scholars with humanist inclinations sought to provide readers with authoritative texts as close as possible to the original sources, while also developing their own editions. There were two general novel things in humanist editions. First, there were editions that lacked the medieval apparatus and abandoned the Glossa Ordinaria template. As the Glossa was seen as cementing the achievements of a period of erroneous medieval interpretation of ancient sources, humanists deprived of their own paratexts, developed their own paratexts, and preferred to dispense with the gloss. Nevertheless, these editions retained summaries and provided comments or paratitla, that is, marginal corrections or notes on the text, such as those authored by Antoine de Mouchy. Second, there were humanist editions that retained the medieval apparatus, but added more extensive notes or scholia, which filled all the remaining space on the page. Through these humanist paratexts, we can observe how differently the authoritative text and the role of the editor were conceived. Interestingly, the paratextual development of Parisian printing of canon law was noted by a professor of the college. In his History of Canon Law, Jean Dujat observed that it was Leconte who first introduced the numbering of the chapters of the Decretum into print. Finally, we should also mention other layers of the paratextual strata that were of non-textual character. Here we can list images, graphic initials, and page layout in general. Nearly all these experiences with editing and enriching the texts of canon law were used and refined by the group of learned editors of the Corpus Juris Canonici, mandated by the Pope and completed in 1582. The Correctores Romani also added numerous additional paratexts, such as their own notes on the transmission of the text, explanations of the glosses, and secondary marginal references to learned authors. Through careful reading of these remarks or changes, we can see how the ancient texts were adapted to post-Tridentine ecclesiastical needs. All types of marginal paratexts across these categories require further investigation. What is needed next is their proper categorization along with the analysis of their history, variants, and functions. And at this point, I turn to the opportunities for future research in this field, beginning with the project of which I am part. There are three main research objectives in Petrus we aim to pursue closely related to those marginalia. First, to comprehend paratext types, functions, origins, variants, and roles in the two corpora iuris printed editions. Second, to examine relations between manuscript paratexts and printed legal book paratexts, methods editors applied when preparing paratexts, and paratext relevance for legal scholarly discourse and teaching. And finally, our third objective is to clarify the role of paratexts as the media of law, assess their relevance to past legal communications and contemporary implications of the past legal experience, if possible. Our overarching hypothesis is that fruitful cooperation between printers and legal scholars led to the rapid and innovative development of paratexts in the two corpora iuris between 1460s and 1620s. The scope of the project is very broad. We want to study paratexts from virtually every dimension. To complicate matters, the source base is voluminous. As there are hundreds of editions of respective parts of the corpora iuris, there is a vast amount of material to investigate. We will use methods from legal history, book history, legal theory, and natural language processing. The latter will, hopefully, enable us to conduct large-scale research on paratextual variants and their use in scholarly literature. Yet another approach could focus more on the key actors in this story, and we also want to keep this perspective in our research. The most obvious and usually the easiest to identify are printers and publishers. Many of them were relevant figures not only for legal publishing, but also for book history in general. On the other end, we have those who used the books, those who sold and bought them, who read and annotated them, who used them for legal purposes and for legal education. These people are rarely identifiable, and thus their perspectives on the usability of printed legal books are far more challenging to reconstruct. However, from the perspective of legal history, the key actors were those in between, the legal experts who acted as editors and prepared new editions for printing. Sometimes they are known by name, but often their identity remains hidden, such as here. Among those whose names have been identified, we can list some of the leading legal scholars of their time, such as Alessandro Nievo or Sebastian Brandt, already mentioned by Professor Compagnon earlier. But also those who are known primarily because of their editorial work and expertise. Here we can point to such important lawyers as Gerolamo Chiari, Jean Chapuis, or Antoine Leconte. And of course, there were also editors about whom we know virtually nothing. These editors were not only involved in the revision of the authoritative text, but most often they were also the originators and creators of the paratextual developments in printed canon law books, both of the external paratexts and of the marginalia. I believe there is much to learn about early printed canon law books by studying the actors involved in their making, dissemination, and use, and in particular those who used their expert legal knowledge to shape the paratextual strata. All of this relates to what Renaud Milazzo recently called typographical normativity, a set of explicit and implicit rules that shape the materiality of printed legal books to produce and communicate its very authority. Editors were among those most actively involved in the shaping of the typographical normativity of early printed legal books. Therefore, research on these figures is to me a crucial task for the future. All these insights, inspired by the approach typical for book history, should be reappropriated for legal history. This can be done in various ways, from a detailed case study to a large comparative survey with the application of NLP techniques. I will provide just three examples. One way forward is to find a method to track the impact of paratext on legal discourse. Such references to paratextual material were infrequent and are difficult to locate within the hundreds of volumes of legal literature. An example of a reference to a summarium was found in the corpus of text dedicated to the early modern Differentiae Iuris Civis et Canonici that I examined in earlier research. The most important book of this kind, Differentiarum Libri Septem, was written by the German humanist lawyer Konrad Rittershausen. In his elegant narrative, he usually described the contents and context of the original Roman and canon law sources. This was also the case with the Differentia from Testamentary Succession dedicated to Quarta Trebellianica, the share of the inheritance that was granted to the heir burdened with bequests. Rittershausen listed two chapters from the Liber Extra as the relevant sources of canon law to this point. But instead of going to the presentation of their contents, he stated simply that it is said in both summaries and added only one remark in parentheses. This is a perfect example of the interpretive and informative functions of summaries, as even the learned author with the humanist approach to the ancient sources did not hesitate to limit himself on this point to much later summaries added to the Decretals. In other instances, we can learn from the paratexts about the perception of the text transmission and attribution. An interesting example is the gloss to Canon Cum Orim, signaled by Edward Reno. In some early printed editions, we can find this long gloss attributed in total to Bernard of Parma. However, in Editio Romana, this gloss has been split into two parts, with the additional remark preceding the second part. Up to here goes Bernard's gloss, what precedes is addition. To this, there was added a secondary marginal note in which the editor claimed that, contrary to this division, the ancient manuscripts confirmed that the two parts of this gloss were written by Bernard himself. Perhaps the most intriguing point is that the division of the gloss into two parts was kept in Editio Romana, contrary to the personal opinion of one of the correctores Romani. This illustrates the ability of paratexts to petrify the doctrinal accounts. The editor preferred to keep the division applied in earlier editions of the Decretals and add only a note, instead of challenging the paratextual scheme of this gloss. And one more thing. Douglas Osler has accurately noted that many legal historians hastily treat early modern printed editions as interchangeable. I believe that research on paratexts can help both to show that such an approach is not adequate, even if it has been followed by many, including myself. Some time ago, no idea why I have used this, it was suggested by the professor here. And to develop criteria for the justified selection of one edition over another for particular purposes. I am convinced that this agenda may also be useful for scholars working on ancient or medieval law, as they also use early printed source editions. Mm-hmm. I hope I have managed to demonstrate how rich in content and questions is the world of printed legal paratexts, even if our knowledge of it remains limited. At this stage, I will refrain from offering general conclusions and instead highlight only three points. First, there is clearly a significant gap in our knowledge of the history of printed legal paratexts. Second, in the case of printed canon law paratexts, we observe a continuous evolution between 1471 and 1582, with a couple of periods of intensified experimentation in the paratextual strata. And third, studying these paratexts will enable us to make new discoveries and deepen our understanding of early modern law in schools, in books, and in courts. Merci.
Merci beaucoup pour cette communication, pour la précédente, qui nous, toutes deux, nous souligne l'importance de comprendre la circulation des textes juridiques pour arriver jusqu'à ce dont on parlait tout à l'heure lors de la première conférence sur leur fossilisation en quelque sorte, et aussi, pour revenir à un point précédemment discuté, sur... une question qui a peu attiré l'attention de beaucoup de juristes jusqu'à présent, qui est que, en se concentrant sur le contenu du texte, on recourait de manière assez indifférente à une édition plutôt qu'une autre, un peu au hasard, sans s'intéresser à cette chaîne de circulation qui évidemment a une énorme influence sur la compréhension du contenu du droit lui-même, et donc. C'est pour ça que ce colloque est particulièrement aussi important pour attirer l'attention des juristes sur ces questions extrêmement importantes pour la compréhension du droit lui-même.
Collège de France, le savoir en illimité. Retrouvez tous nos contenus audio et vidéo sur notre site collège-de-france.fr, les plateformes de podcast et nos chaînes YouTube.